And morning to you. Good morning, I guess. Natasha Mitchell joining you for your week with Life Matters here on ABC RN across Australia. In just a moment on the program, we want to engage with personal reactions to the massacres in Paris over the weekend. And I think you might also have had your own reactions, because perhaps you've walked through those neighbourhoods, as so many Australians have. Perhaps you know the communities closely who were targeted by ISIS terrorists on Saturday across Paris. And indeed on Thursday, in a Shia neighbourhood of southern Beirut, in what has been described as the deadliest bombing in the city since the civil war ended 25 years ago. Vale all, everywhere, those Lebanese innocents taken by suicide bombers, travellers on a Russian plane in Egypt, now joyous concert and restaurant goers massacred in Paris. They are interconnected lives and deaths, is my feeling this morning. And what is the world to do about ISIS? And certainly we'll be probing that question today on RN throughout the week. Late Night Live tonight, we'll be picking up specifically on the events in Beirut, as well as Paris. RN drivers from 6pm with Patricia Carvelis as well. This morning on Life Matters, though, we want to focus on the personal and the intimate responses. In the second half of today's program, I want you to channel your inner child and the school teachers who helped make you what you are.
Many of them are not even aware of what kinds of heights they are going to be able to scale and what kinds of amazing things they're going to be able to go out into the world with this education as part of them and go and achieve and go and do and go and serve their communities. I think that's amazing, and that's why I'm committed to it. It's mathematics as a performance. It's full of mysteries and surprises. And for me to convey that to them is a whole body, whole mind, whole heart experience.
We want to bring Eddie Wu to the airwaves today to, I guess, instill in us hope for humanity. Teachers give us great hope. Eddie Wu of WooTube fame and acclaim, a high school teacher in suburban Sydney who is taking the world by storm, in fact, on YouTube, or WooTube, one video at a time. And we're going to use that conversation with Eddie to launch a new project here on Life Matters, My Favourite Teacher, and stay tuned to find out how to nominate yours, celebrating terrific teachers this coming month on Life Matters.
I felt like I needed to come here with old French people and other people from all around the world, just to think about what happened.
For me, there's not another place where I can really express my feelings and express my solidarity. It's only here, Place de la République.
Yes, voices from the streets of Paris and from the Notre Dame in Paris, which opened its doors again on Sunday to hold a service to bring Parisians together after unimaginable events this past weekend on the streets of that beautiful city. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Liberty, equality, fraternity, words we know are enshrined in France's national motto, but words definitely put to the test this past weekend as a coordinated wave of terrorist attacks by gunmen in Paris has now left, well, likely 130 people dead at least, more than 350 people wounded, around 100 in a critical condition. ISIS has claimed responsibility for this shocking brutality. Their targets, innocents, concert goers, restaurant goers, enjoying a Saturday night out in the bohemian neighbourhoods of Paris. And joining us this morning, two cultural leaders here in Australia who hold Paris and indeed those very neighbourhoods close to their hearts. A French citizen, Jean-François Ponsieu, is the organiser of So Frenchy, So Chic, the music festival held here in Australia annually. He spent the past couple of decades in Australia. After arriving here in his 20s, he gets back home to France and to Paris each year, though. Welcome to you, Jean-François.
Good morning.
We also have with us in the studio Australian Gemma Birrell. She's Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. Before taking up that role, she lived and worked in Paris over a number of years as the events director for one of the world's most iconic bookshops, Shakespeare and Co. The bookshop became a safe haven on the night of the attacks. Good morning to you, Gemma.
Hi, Natasha.
Thanks for being here. It's been a weekend for you, Gemma, of connecting with your dear friends back in Paris, and even this morning you've been doing that.
Yeah, that was definitely the first thing. I mean, hearing about this early on Saturday morning, a friend was texting me and I had no idea what was happening, and then rapidly just sent messages to everyone I knew to make sure they were okay. Mm. Yeah, it's been absolutely shocking, and I think everyone over there is still reeling, absolutely reeling from it.
That little bookshop, that iconic space that you know so intimately, actually became a safe haven over the weekend for people. Do you know what happened there?
Yes, actually, Harriet, who used to work at the bookshop, wrote a piece about it, and they, people who were around it in the bookshop at the time, it's open quite late, and so they closed the doors, and it was a safe haven for people. People stayed there. They stayed there protected. They knew it was a safe place. They felt it was a safe place, and I think they blackened the windows and just made sure that everyone was okay who was already in there.
There's a motto that sits on a sign in that little bookshop, which feels really poignant this morning. The words are, "Be not inhospitable to strangers, lest they be angels in disguise." And there's a profound paradox there when you think about the identities, likely identities of some of the terrorists who were welcomed into the French community in some way.
There is. But I also think the message there is to constantly think about the good in people, you know, and the positive. So I think that's really the feeling of the message for me, you know, to keep having hope and you know, having positive thoughts about people rather than going to the negative, which I think is going to be very important in the forthcoming period. Yeah, I really do.
Tell us about the photos that you've seen from a little cafe that you know very, very well indeed. You lived near this cafe, Le Carillon. You went there every Sunday with friends and extended networks.
I did. So Le Carillon is a beautiful cafe in the 10th arrondissement, right on the Rue Alibert, which is where every Sunday there was a market, and me and all of my friends would meet religiously at Le Carillon. I mean, it's such a community centre. Families come for their morning coffee on the weekends and the market, and everyone would meet there, or in the evening have drinks out on the terrace outside, as was happening on that Friday night. And, I just lived a few, you know, for a period I was living very close by, and then I always came back to that cafe on Sundays because it was that meeting point in the community. It's very welcoming staff, beautiful people there. You know, at any time you'd walk in and you'd see someone you knew, or there'd be someone playing Django Reinhardt or, you know, kind of live jazz in there. It was just totally lacking in pretension, beautiful little cafe, du quartier of the neighbourhood, you know.
And it's a little neighbourhood. It's a close neighbourhood. It's an intimate neighbourhood. It's unfathomable, really, isn't it, to imagine that it would become a target for a global terrorism story.
It's utterly bizarre. I think people can't believe it. I mean, this is they call it the bubble area, which is, you know, it's the young bohemian artistic kind of people who often live there on the Canal Saint-Martin, which is just, again, a minute from the cafe. People are kind of lined along there drinking beer with their legs over the side of the canal. It is the place that kind of represents summer and just where you'd go out for a drink with your friends, you know. Like, we had parties there at the Carillon. Luke Davies, the Australian writer, we kind of had one of his farewells there. It's just it had that solid kind of Café du Quartier, you know, café of the area.
And now it's become a shrine. People, your friends there have sent you photos of what it's become.
Yeah, so I initially got one photo and there was a few flowers that people were leaving on our time Saturday morning. And since then, you know, I've just been seeing pictures of thousands of people milling around Le Carillon and Le Petit Cambodge and leaving, you know, flowers and thoughts and candles. Yeah, I think it's, you know, that kind of solidarity and that support for everyone. I think, it's really moving to see that from afar.
Jean-François Poncieux, what was your first reaction to the news as it was coming through from Paris over the weekend?
I firstly got up on Saturday morning, got a text from my sister. She said, "We're okay, we're home." And I was surprised why she was sending me that text. And then as the news started to feed, there was a bit of shock and unknown. And then it was a total shock because, you know, we know these streets very well. It's an attack on our way of life. We go to this restaurant, we go to the stadiums, we go to concerts. And you know, a lot of friends in the music industry over there runs the concert halls and things like that. So it feels very close to home. My sister lives not far from there. Mm. I was there 6 months ago, Rue Fontaine-au-Roi, having a coffee. So, you know, it is closed.
Does Gemma's description of those neighbourhoods resonate with you?
Oh, yeah, totally, you know. It's joie de vivre, café, enjoy life. You know, it's the Paris as we like it.
You've also long been involved in the music industry. You run Cartel Music. You are the founder of the So Frenchy, So Chic Music Festival and compilations. To think that a concert hall would be the target is unfathomable, isn't it?
It is, but at the same time, you know, it's... so is the restaurant and the stadium. I don't think the concert hall is the thing. It's more the way we live. Mm. And I think that the most important thing is that beyond the shock, we have to be determined and to fight for our values that define who we are and how we live. And, you know, I really hope this electroshock will help people appreciate what we have and our way of living. And also, I think we have to stay united against all these fascists because it happened in Tunisia 2 months ago. It happened in Beirut, as you mentioned before. It's happening now in Paris. So this form of fascism has no religion, no color of skin, nothing. It's just targeting people to impose totalitarianism.
How does that need to happen, that unity, from your perspective, in the country that you know so well, when there are clearly fractures there are clearly tensions within the community? Racism exists within the French community. There is a polarisation, isn't there, between migrant members of the Parisian community and locals?
I mean, it's sure that for the last 40 years there's been big mistakes made into integrations of migrants in France, and we've seen the 2005 uprisal against which was quite full on. So there is this tension in the society, but I think, you know, there is also Galvani's moment where people need to unite, and maybe this is one of them. I think, you know, our roles as citizen and is to appease and to hope that people are going to understand that they're all in the same place together, and they have to make to find solution. We need the Muslim community to help us through this process, and we can't. Be against them. They are our brothers as much as we've got our families and friends, you know. they're the one that should help us as well within this process.
Daniel Byman, Research Director for the Centre for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, Institute, Jean-Francois, wrote over the weekend that it's this France's official policies, like hostility to public displays of religion, the veiling of women, satirical magazines like Charlie Hebdo, this mix of aggression, critical free speech and secularism is what he points to as being a reason for why France has become a target.
I think that France has become a target because someone declared a caliphate and they've got all bunch of freaks going there and now they're trying to change our way of life. France is a target as much as other countries are a target for whatever they find would justify them to do such actions. So I think, you know, everyone's a target on this thing because it's a target on our way of life and it's a target on how our values. So I think that, you know, if you want to pick a fight with someone, you always find a reason.
Mm. Gemma Birrell, one of your dear friends, someone you worked with at Shakespeare and Company, the iconic bookshop that became a haven, in fact lived across the road from the Le Petit Cambodge, excuse my French pronunciation, one of the restaurants that was targeted just across the road from La Carillon, the cafe.
Mm.
Did she describe the events to you in any detail?
She could hear it happening. So there was a few, when I was sending messages, you know, frantically to everyone that I knew, there was a few people like her who came back and said that she literally is living currently next door and so could hear the noise and the firing and she's really shaken. So so she was next door and there was other people, you know, a friend of mine who's in the 11th and she was putting her child to sleep and could hear different rounds of machine guns and so it's really close. I mean, it's really affecting everyone. And I was just speaking to a friend of mine this morning who was saying that everyone is really, all these people are in hospital. We don't know who exactly was affected yet. There's some kind of information that's coming out, you know, on some of the victims, but there are a lot of people that we don't know about yet and who are in hospital. And so I think, you know, the whole country will very much be in grief and, it's just unfolding over the next few days, I think, the extent of it.
For you, I mean, yes, connecting with people, but in fact there was there's an app that Facebook rolled out.
Yes,
as part of this crisis that became paramount for you.
Oh, I was looking through that immediately and looking because people were, it was the Safe app that they put out and I just saw people starting to kind of check in and then there'd be various people who hadn't checked in. So that was definitely something we were all doing, going through that app and checking on everyone's safety. So, I mean, I think that was quite useful. And then if there was anyone who you didn't know and they hadn't checked in, you know, everyone would be kind of sending each other messages saying, have you heard from Thomas or have you heard from, you know, Ziad or various other friends? Yeah.
With us this morning is Gemma Birrell, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers Festival, lived in France, worked in France and in Paris particularly for many years. Jean-Francois Poncieux is with us too. He is the founder, director of So Frenchy, So Chic, the music festival, a French man. How do you see, Gemma, the challenge ahead for the Parisian community, the French community?
Well, I think Jean-Francois really captured it. And I think there's kind of this urge to stay strong, the solidarité, you know, for people to kind of not be overly affected with their way of life and continue to be strong in the way that they live. I mean, having a drink on a terrace is a way of life. That's being outside, having a drink with friends. I think it's going to be hard. I think it's really hard with that anxiety at the moment and that fear. And also I think, you know, like the owner of the cafe, I was reading an article in The Guardian and the owner of Le Carillon was saying, they're not Muslims, they're terrorists. And I think really...
and indeed the owner of Le Carillon is Algerian.
Yes, yes. And everyone, I think, just really needs to be together and to support... to support each other. I just, you know, I'd hate to see things more fractured, you know. I mean, that's the fear, isn't it?
So. Just reflecting for both of you briefly and finally, both of you are cultural leaders in Australia. You know the value, the power of the arts and of communities coming together in the creative industries, I guess. And those very communities were targeted by this terrorist act in Paris. Music crowds, restaurants, a football game. I wonder how you see the value of the arts to bring a community together at a time like this. Jean-Francois.
Oh, I think it's fundamental because culture generate emotions in whatever form it's expressed. And I think it's a very good catalyst, an important catalyst. And it's also, you know, what define who we are, what we stand for, and the things we like in life. And I think that's important.
Do you see art as a powerful force at a time like this? It's not a trivial question. It sounds like it is, but it's not.
No, not at all. No, I do. I think, you know, we have Charlie Hebdo, for example. You know, it's writers, artists are essential. You know, they're essential to expression, freedom of speech, and just continuing to have that strength and that insight. I think they really bring different perspectives and different insights, and they also allow, you know, the strength of words that really helps getting people kind of with the solidarity, bringing people together, helping people understand, and also just go through all the different emotions and express them. Because I think, you know, even what people have been posting on Facebook, we're all sharing these experiences, and it's through people's writing and hearing about people's experience that really, that's helping everyone, I think.
All strength to your loved ones back in Paris. Take care this week. And Gemma Birrell, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. Jean-Francois, you too, take care this week.
Thank you. I wanted to say that culture is what represents the democracy. It's the cement of the democracy. And a well-functioning democracy has a well-functioning culture scene.
Thank you indeed, and take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jean-Francois, he is the director of the So Frenchy, So Chic Music Festival here in Australia, on again in January in Melbourne and Sydney, and the Sydney Writers' Festival, of course, an extravaganza that really brings alive some of these complex discussions and debates actually through literary means each year. Natasha Mitchell with you here on ABC RN across the nation. For Life Matters, coming up, Eddie Wu of WooTube fame and acclaim, and we're launching My Favourite Teacher.
Teaching and learning should bring joy.
When they're really, really excited about something, you grab that and you go with it.
I was given the opportunity to teach a class of first graders, and from that day, I was hooked.
You could see the change that you can affect on kids.
I really was just passionate about making a difference through teaching.
I think you see kids and you form relationships in a way that probably nobody else ever does.
The students will enjoy what they're doing, and in the process, they learn.
You know, kids don't learn from people they don't like.
Yes, we're launching something new on Life Matters this morning. My Favourite Teacher is the name. Celebrating terrific teachers in our lives is the game, because great teachers, of course, can transform our lives. They're often the unsung heroes of our childhoods. We pass through their lives. They pass through ours. So we want to help you acknowledge and to celebrate a school teacher who has made a positive difference in your life. Tell us who your favourite school teacher was and why. We want to hear your nominations over the coming weeks. Tell us what made them so great. How did they influence you to nominate a school teacher? Go to the Life Matters homepage, click on My Favourite Teacher on the right-hand side. That takes you through to a special page where you can post your nominations. Be sure to include your email address in the form there, because we're going to track down a few of your favourite teachers and interview them for Life Matters. And you can help us spread the word. so we can get as many nominations across the country as possible by using the hashtag MyFavouriteTeacher. Well, to inspire your own stories for My Favourite Teacher, this morning an opportunity to meet a young teacher who has become a big hit in his classroom. But here's the thing, his classroom has become vast, spilling well beyond the confines of his high school in Western Sydney to the big, wide world. It's Eddie Wu of WooTube fame and acclaim. He's head mathematics teacher at Cherrybrook Technology High School in Western Sydney. He's a father of three small children too. His passion for teaching and love of learning is infectious. And Eddie picked up the 2015 New South Wales Premier's Prize for Innovation in Science and Mathematics Education last month. And I wanted to invite him into the Life Matters studio to get a rare glimpse, really, into the daily life of a working teacher. Welcome, Eddie.
It's great to be here.
And congratulations on winning the New South Wales Premier's Prize for Innovation in Science and Maths Education.
Oh, it was an enormous privilege. Yeah, I almost didn't feel like I deserved to be among those, you know, incredible luminaries of the science and mathematics world, but it's an enormous honour.
Must have been very exciting. You always knew somehow that you wanted to be a teacher from way back when.
It was in the middle of high school when I started to get a sense of watching other people learn. When I was often not the smartest person, but people would say, "Hey, how does this work? Can you explain that?" And I just sort of naturally fit into that mold. But I think what really grabbed hold of me was when I first started to see an idea just click really clearly in someone's mind, and literally for the lights to come on for them. And I very quickly became addicted to that. I thought sort of everyone loved that kind of seeing that and being able to help someone else get that. Mm. But the more I talked to my friends, they said to me, no, it's just you, you know, we're really glad that you love it, but no one seems to love it quite like you do. So
a natural born teacher, it seems.
Something like that.
It seems. Although you did go to one of the most elite selective high schools in New South Wales, one of the big performers, the high performers, very competitive, very ambitious school culture, I would imagine. What was the response around you to your desire to become a teacher and not a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer or a CEO? How do people respond to this desire in you?
I certainly raised some eyebrows. A lot of people, frankly, were just confused. They thought, why? And I suppose this just feeds into the broader attitude towards education. Even some of my own teachers, who I think eventually became really pleased with the fact that I did this, but they were just puzzled because it was just so apart from the normal stream and the normal direction that most people in a school like that are heading towards. A lot of people did say to me, do you know, the income is going to be like this and the lifestyle is going to be like this. And what it always came back to me for was the next generation is just this enormous opportunity there to reach out to them, to strengthen them, to help them to grow. I just couldn't imagine a place where I would be more able to use my skills and more gratified by being able to help people. I absolutely fell in love with it.
I was really intrigued by that response around you, though, because it says something about our attitude in Australia towards the teaching profession, that you even got that message from your own teachers. Why would you become a teacher when you can become a mining magnate, for example?
People didn't need to tell me, we're surprised that this is something you want to go into, because I just needed to look around and it wasn't even on the table. It wasn't one of the, all right, here's your quiz that you can go through and identify your strengths and this is the likely path you're going to go into. No one in the years above me, certainly no one in my year, and no one after me for quite a substantial time even considered it. It was just not on the table. And I thought that was a shame. I think that's changing. I think there's lots of avenues to increase people's valuing of teachers, because it's just such a magnificent, noble profession. But yeah, those things come slowly.
What about your parents? Migrant parents, Chinese heritage.
My parents were surprised to begin with, because for them, education is so important. It's also a means towards, and not in a bad way, but it's a means towards securing your future. And they very much wanted, they left behind everything to come to this country and in order for their children to have every opportunity. And I think for me to have chosen a profession which maybe didn't quite have the status of all the other options that were open to me. That surprised them, certainly, at first. I think eventually they came around. It took some time. My mother passed away in my first year of uni, so she never really got to see it all pan out. But my father, he's really delighted at how much success I've been able to have as a teacher, and he can clearly see how much I love what I'm doing and having a positive impact on the young people around me.
And you have become a star of the internet, which we will just hear shortly. But you were passionate about history and English at school, and here you are winning awards for being a maths teacher. What happened? Why maths?
Sure. I would like to say, even though it does seem a little bit like when it's couched in those terms, I've sort of been going in one direction and then taken a very sharp turn, I like to think about the continuity between all of these different fields. I don't see myself so much as a teacher of my subject as much as a teacher of students, and I want every sphere to be involved with that. Just this morning, I was studying the life of Alan Turing and the incredible story that he has as a mathematician, but also the enormous impact he's made on our society. And so for me, I really feel like everything I loved and learned in, I did the highest level of English I could and the highest level of history that I could. And I took those principles. I took my love for crafting a narrative. And I took my understanding of history and rivaling perspectives and how an incredible story is mapped out, but just by human beings interacting with each other. I take all of that and I bring it into my mathematics classroom, and I think that it's richer for the sake of it.
And also, you take it to the internet. And so Mr. WooTube was born.
I'm Mr. Woo, and my channel is all about learning. I love doing it, and I love helping others to do it too. I guess that's why I became a teacher.
Every day, when I walk into my classroom, I set up my camera, I turn on my microphone, and I record my lessons. It's real teaching, real people, and my hope is that it's real learning for everyone who watches, whether you're in the room with me or halfway across the other side of the world. So if you want to learn about mathematics, or the way that technology works, or pick up a musical instrument, or if you just want to understand life in general, then I hope you'll join me and we can learn together.
More than 1 million views, more than 10,000 subscribers from around the world and growing, more than 1,000 videos. Your internet alter ego, Mr. Woo, has just gone off.
It's been as much a surprise to me as anyone else. I really was never intended for a wide audience. And so I've been really quite surprised by how many people. I mean, I've been doing this for 3 years now. And as you said, it's just been doing its own thing, growing.
Tell me the story behind Mr. WooTube.
Sure.
And how that came about.
I had a single student who I was teaching in a year 10 class, and he was diagnosed with a very serious illness that required him to be out of school and in school for a few weeks at a time, but out of school for many consecutive weeks. And as I mentioned, mathematics is so coherent and so interconnected that every time he'd come back, he would work as hard as he could to understand what was going on. But he was really trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle without all of the pieces. And so I thought, come on, surely we can do something better than just sending home the exercises that he's supposed to do and saying, good luck, he's the textbook. And so I just took my phone out and I propped it up on top of the table. I worked out eventually that was not very stable. So I went down to the woodwork room. I slapped together a few pieces of wood so it would stand still. And then I started putting those up on YouTube, honestly, because I was too lazy to package them up specifically and send them to him. I said, look, here's a link. You can go and use it. And then within my classroom, because it was fairly obvious, students who were not in that position, who were at school all the time, they'd say, oh, so I just missed a day because I was out at Knockout Touch. Can I look at the video for that lesson? And I'd say, if you want to spend your own time doing, you know, a bit more maths, I'm never going to stop that. And so they started to use it, even though they were there in the classroom. They started to use it for revision because how hard is it to remember something you learned? I can hardly remember the breakfast I had 2 weeks ago, let alone these complicated concepts we've learned months and months ago. And from there, it kind of just spread. It spread to all these students. In some ways, that wasn't as much of a surprise because students were my intended audience. Mm. But when I went back to my old university of Sydney, And I was involved with some of the pre-service teacher training there and helping out a few university students who were not that far behind me. And they said, oh, yeah, we watched your videos. They were really helpful for our assessment that we would do on this, that, the other. And I said, really? Why? And they said, well, you know, and this, now that I know it, it's so obvious. Number one, as a university student, it's pretty hard to get actually into a classroom. They have their student placements, but they're very, very limited. And once you become a teacher, as an early career teacher, early career teachers have, you know, no time. You know, people have 24 hours a day. No, early career teachers do not have 24 hours a day. They have very little opportunity to go and sit in on someone's classroom and just watch how someone else explains it.
So in a sense, it's become a virtual classroom for teachers, for students, and you now also have WooTube 2, which is specifically for resourcing teachers, helping teachers build their confidence in the maths classroom and beyond. What impact has it had in your classroom?
It's been surprising. I mean, I'm still teaching the same way. The camera is there. It's just an iPad sitting in the middle of the room attached to a microphone. And I work as hard as I can to make sure the students in my room are not feeling like they're getting something secondhand, that I'm teaching to the internet and then they're there for the ride. They are my students. But I feel like what gets onto the camera is better as a result, because I'm focused on them. I'm focused on human beings. And it's mathematics as a performance. It's full of mysteries and surprises, and for me to convey that to them is a whole body, whole mind, whole heart experience.
So you use words, expressions like practically powerful, dazzlingly beautiful, mysteriously logical, endlessly surprising. These are words that people would not necessarily have associated with their experience of maths in their own high school classrooms. Why are those words relevant to maths in your mind?
There are so many things that I could say here. I mean, just off the top of my head, the quickest examples I can think of are all things that we experience from day-to-day life but maybe don't realize are as mathematical as they are. Those words won't come to people's minds when they think of mathematics. I think that reflects that we don't actually understand what mathematics is. Mm. So when I'm looking at, this is one of my favorite examples, when I look at a flower, and I look at the petals and in the middle, there's all of those seeds there, and they trace out a really interesting spiral pattern. Why do they do that? And the answer has to do with irrational numbers, and a particular irrational number that mathematicians love called the golden ratio. And so the mathematics is there, hidden in plain sight. And, you know, I'm not a very musical person, but I love music. I love to listen to it. I do love to dabble with it. And
oh, yeah, yeah. There's you giving guitar lessons as well, as maths lessons, you know, on your YouTube channel.
It's funny how, I mean, every musical instrument is a mathematical piece of art. I mean, just to pick out a guitar, why is it that a note struck on a guitar string sounds so harmonious with a note struck on the same string when I divide it in half? And that's all mathematics. It has to do with the periodicity of trigonometric wave functions, but we don't realize that. Mm. If we are to convey to students, this is what mathematics is really about, and this is how wonderful an experience learning can be, it's a little bit as though, you know, students have to learn about music but never get to hear a symphony. I think that's tragic. And it's wonderful when anyone gets to experience that.
Eddie Wu is with us this morning. He's head mathematics teacher at a school in Western Sydney called Cherrybrook Technology High School. He's also the winner of the New South Wales Premier's Prize for Innovation in Science and Mathematics Education recently. And he is Mr. Wu of Mr. WooTube acclaim and fame. His YouTube channel, which has taken the world by storm and classrooms by storm, it would seem. You argue that maths at school is missing a crucial ingredient. What is that crucial ingredient?
Mathematics often is reduced down to, here are some problems that can be solved with a series of steps. And if you are really good at replicating those steps and become very efficient and quick at them, then we label that, you're good at mathematics. Well done, you get an A+. And I think that's really taking the heart and soul out of what mathematics is and presenting kind of a shell. I mean, it's not nothing. Those processes of developing fluency and understanding are important. But really what's at the heart of mathematics, which I think often is missed in classrooms, is that Mathematics is just about something very simple. It's the human drive to understand. What are the principles and logic that animate this world around us? You know, simple things like, okay, why is it that our planet is round? I watch TV with my children and they're 2, 4, and 7, and we watch this show which has the characters racing around on rockets to planets which are cubes and pyramids. And why don't we, there's actually a really good reason why every planet and every star and every other big celestial object is basically a sphere, a circle, because of the rules of physical laws and how they have to do with distances and radii and so on. And so that drive
maths
to understand
is there in the worldliness.
Yeah.
But do you think it's also intensely personal?
Mm.
And that message, that possibility is lost on a lot of people who attribute maths to a great source of anxiety in their lives.
Absolutely. I think it's and I understand. I do see when things do get reduced down to, all right, here's a bunch of processes you need to do. I mean, I can just imagine what it would be like if as a someone playing a sport, if what that sport meant to me was, okay, how many times can I dribble this soccer ball in between these cones and how quickly can I do it? And when they give me half an hour, how many will I miss and what kind of grade will I get at the end? Well, no wonder people would be anxious if that's their experience of sport. But if they get to say, okay, I want to push my body and my mind to its limits. I want to collaborate together with other people and see how my skills and their skills can fit together in a complementary way. That's fun. That's why we play team sports. And real life mathematics is very much like that. It's a collaborative effort to try and take what we understand and put it together with others to yield insight.
Mm, mm. Children are born scientists, you argue. Are they born mathematicians too, do you think?
If mathematics is all about, I think that if I can understand the patterns underneath what's going on, then I can have more fun with something and I can really understand how it works and push it to its limits, then I think we absolutely are all born as mathematicians. I mean, the idea of thinking about, okay, well, you know, I want to play with my toys. I want to maximize the amount of time that I can have with them and I want to play with this one and that one and how many different combinations. I mean, my 4-year-old son, he's really into Lego at the moment, as many children that age are, and to the consternation of my feet when I step on his Legos, which I did to my parents, so I have no surprises there. For him to just play and for me to watch the concentration on his face as he thinks about the geometry of how he's putting together what he wants and how to match the colors in exactly the right configuration, all of that is deep mathematical understanding. And he would never express it that way, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
So at what point do you think we lose confidence?
Mathematics is tricky in that more than any other field, because there's such continuity and interconnectedness between all of the skills and concepts in mathematics.
And it's abstract.
Absolutely. In fact, the power of mathematics is that it can be abstracted and that we talk about simple things like, say, like circles, there isn't a circle the way that we would think about it mathematically. There isn't a single circle in the universe. I mean, I'm staring at my watch right now and it looks like a circle. But if we took a microscope to it and had a look at all the lumps and bumps around the edges, it's nothing at all like a circle.
Mm.
But the fact that we can understand circles in this mathematical abstract way still gives us this tremendous power. But coming back to why students often disengage and have trouble and their attitude towards it will radically shift. I think because of that massive interconnectedness between the ideas, it can honestly be at any single point in the chain. I mean, the colloquial way we'd say it is, you know, you might have one bad year for whatever reasons it is. Maybe your life took a bit of a personal turn and so you couldn't focus on your studies, or perhaps you moved and changed systems and so there was a bit of a disconnect, or maybe the teacher who you had just didn't quite have the confidence or the passion to explain what they were talking about. Just one year can really sever the connection between all of the concepts that are to come. That's a wonderful thing about mathematics, that it builds on itself and that's how it reaches these amazing heights of abstraction and insight. But therefore, those foundations need to be so strong and so powerful. It's never too late, but our education system does move forward at a particular pace.
Mm.
And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's a reality. And so mathematics education often struggles as a result of that.
You know, I've tried to convince 16-year-old girls to stay on in maths, for example, and I can't convince them. Their parents have lost the fight because they too have lost confidence in their maths as well when they were young. And they, well, I won't need it. Why will I need CERTs? Mm. I want to go and work in this field. Why would I need maths for that? Mm. How do you convey that message to parents and your kids in the classroom?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. Just to take the classic question, when am I ever going to need this? I think there's been a lot of attempts, very well-intentioned as well, which I appreciate, attempts to try and take mathematics learning and say, let's really make it practical. Let's make the context really clear and make the application to a student's real life also really clear. Mm. And that can work really marvelously well. I've been involved in many projects that have tried to do that effectively and have seen the fruits of it. But at the same time, I think there's something a little bit mistaken about that approach. We can see how it's flawed if we try to take that principle and apply it to something else, like, say, English. So I love English, and I particularly love creative writing and fiction. And can we imagine a scene where a teacher walks into the classroom and says, all right, everyone, you know, 9C, I've worked out why you didn't like that last novel I gave you. It wasn't practical enough for you. And that's why the next text we're going to be studying is 800 pages of, you know, supply chain economics in the automotive industry. You know, but sir, can't we just read, you know, Lord of the Rings? Oh, no, that's not practical enough for you. I mean, the ludicrousness of it is so obvious in an area like that. And yet we're trying to do the same thing in mathematics, which I think is a mistake. I mean, mathematics is beautiful and fun in its own right. Any student can take a little puzzle and manipulate the shapes. In fact, puzzles are a perfect example. You know, when you take a jigsaw and you're thinking about it geometrically, the mathematics that's involved there is really actually quite profound. And no one's going to say, oh, but sir, when am I ever going to have to put a jigsaw puzzle together in real life? It's like, well, no, that's not the point. You're developing skills of, you know, how do you approach a problem? How do you tackle a situation where you've got all these unknowns and you have pieces that you know can fit together, but you don't know how? Those are all broad principles, which they're going to be useful even if it's not, oh, yes, this is my job.
I'm hearing your interactions with your students right now. What do you love about being in that classroom? What do you love about your students?
There's so many things to love. Just interacting with these human beings who are really, at their best moments, struggling very hard to wrap their heads around incredibly difficult concepts and trying to master incredibly difficult skills. And one of the things which I get to see every day is for them to struggle and persevere, and for it finally to pay off for them, to realize, to get to that moment where, wow, I did that. It's the kind of sense of achievement you get when you've scaled, you know, a rock climbing wall or something like that, and you look back down and you think, I was down there. How did I get up here? I didn't know my arms and legs could do that. And in the mathematics classroom, I didn't know that just my mind and a pen and paper, and I could go from here to here, and that's just amazing.
It's a joy for you to watch that.
Exactly. That's right. And I love to see the creativity and imagination that students apply toward. I mean, most people don't think of maths as a very creative or imaginative pursuit, but it absolutely is. I mean, as much as I love history and say science, they're by their nature limited by what we can observe, what we can experiment on, what we can repeat. But mathematics alone is only limited by what you can dream up in your mind.
What do you think makes a good teacher?
It's kind of funny because, particularly as an early career teacher, I made it a big habit for myself to say, look, students are really expert at working out who's a good teacher, who's an ineffective teacher. They know very quickly, within seconds of you walking into the room, actually. Not to say that they're necessarily experts at what a teacher should be. You know, they know what they want, not necessarily what they need.
They want the funky teacher.
Exactly, you know. But at the same time, I thought it's really important to recognize student voice and that they see teachers come and go and they see things very quickly. So I made it a point to always ask my students, look, can you rate me on here are some qualities, you know, well-organized, knows my stuff, disciplines the classroom, all those kinds of things. Can you rate me on those? Tell me what I need to work on, what kinds of things that I'm doing poorly at and can improve. And what I put at the bottom of the form was, here are the qualities I've identified. Can you pick out some qualities that I haven't mentioned that you think are important? And can you give me a rating on them then? And I was so fascinated by the number one, the range of responses, but number two, so frequently, the things that came up were actually, honestly, from what I had expected, They were nothing to do with being a teacher. Mm. They were nothing about subject knowledge. They were nothing about understanding of curriculum and that kind of thing. They were things like, has a sense of humor, is willing to give me a hand when I'm struggling, you know, listens to me, doesn't necessarily just do what I want, but is going to take the desires that I have, which every student has their own different strengths and wishes, and take it into account. Those aren't necessarily teacher qualities. They're just human qualities.
Eddie, we're about to launch this new project today, in fact, with this interview. We're asking Life Matters listeners to nominate their favourite teacher, a teacher who made a difference in their lives. Are you happy to nominate a favourite teacher from your own life, a teacher that really made a difference for you in this career choice or in your life?
This is so hard for me because I was blessed to have so many fantastic teachers. And so when I was trying to rack my brains thinking, which one do I pick out? There is one who I can pick out, and honestly, he's probably the primary reason that I myself became a teacher. His name was Mr. Brown. He was my agriculture teacher in year 7. He was also the head of agriculture at my school. And what struck me most about him, and which I've never forgotten, is that one day we were walking down from our classroom down to the agriculture plots where we were supposed to be, you know, harvesting our plants or whatever it was. And we were walking across the oval, and it's a fair walk. And so we're all talking amongst ourselves, and he turned to me and he said, "So how are you today, Eddie?" And I kind of looked at him because I was, here I am, this very small, rather easily intimidated year 7 student. And I'm not really used to having a conversation with a teacher. I mean, is he asking me a question? Is this a test? Am I going to pass? You know? And he sensed that I hesitated, and he said, "I'm just interested in how your day's been and how you're traveling." And I thought this, I wasn't articulate enough to say it at the time, but I thought he cares about us as human beings. I mean, I knew I was no star student in his agriculture class. It was not as though I was, oh yes, he's gonna take me as that wonderful star pupil. He really just treated me as a fellow human being and was interested in who I was and what drove me and what I liked and what I was good at. That one conversation I've replayed in my head thousands of times. Every time I interact with a student, I think to myself, he had no reason on that day to single me out. There was nothing special about me. And so when I look at my students, there's so many of them. It can be overwhelming. A normal teacher has in a high school 150 students that they have to know and work with every year. And it's really easy to let them get lost in a sort of sea of faces. But every one of them's an individual. Every one of them has a personal story. Mm. And that made a deep impact on me that he cared about that.
Eddie Wu, thank you so much, so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Eddie Wu, he is head mathematics teacher at Cherrybrook Technology High School in Western Sydney. And last month he picked up the 2015 New South Wales Premier's Prize for Innovation in Science and Mathematics Education. He is certainly a favourite teacher for many. And you can check out his WooTube channel by going to the Life Matters website. Look for the story there and you'll find it. Mr. WooTube on Twitter to you. Now, that launches our My Favourite Teacher project. And what we want to hear from you is your nomination for a teacher who transformed your life in some way, who made a big difference for you. And to nominate a teacher and tell us why they made a difference, tell us a little story about them, go to the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Look for My Favourite Teacher. Click on the link on the right-hand side and go through and post your nomination there right now and spread the word for us on social media. Let's celebrate terrific teachers. You can use the hashtag #MyFavouriteTeacher. Go for it, folks. And our listener feedback line, 02-833-1430. Well, that's it from us today. Thank you for your company. And I'll join you next on Life Matters, coming up to the news.